health crisis as an alibi for restrictive measures. Since last week, the head of police has forbidden a demonstration in name of the COVID-19 crisis. This law has only one interest, to silence demonstrators.
Earlier this week, the Council of Ministers decided to close the main association against Islamophobia in France, the CCIF. French Interior Minister Darmanin qualified the CCIF as an enemy of the Republic and accused it of incitement to hatred and violence, discrimination, and of encouraging terrorism.
That's very surprising, because the CCIF has always profiled itself on the judicial scene and very little as political activists. The association limited itself to defend the legitimate rights of the Muslims. Now, in the context of an upsurge of terrorist attacks since 2015, the French government has entered in a phase of escalation of repressive measures that seriously limit the democratic liberties.
Amnesty International declared that dissolving the CCIF is a violation of freedom of association.
As for now, the French government remains inflexible towards the social protest. The tensions are rising in high government circles about the way the security issue in France is handled. The protesters promise not to give up until an important part of the law is cancelled. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, the European Defence Agency annual conference has taken place online. The event, which has just concluded, normally attracts protests as it brings together arms dealers, policymakers and politicians, while civil society representatives are banned. The usual rhetoric was peddled out at this year's conference, however.
We have to look together into the rise of China and also these issues. Speaking of Russia, they have developed, and they are developing as we speak, super advanced missile systems.
Campaigners say the EU and NATO create security threats to feed the arms industry, which is active in every one of the EU's 27 nations and has an annual turnover of more than 100 billion euro. The ongoing process to create an EU army means that even more taxpayers' money is being spent at a time when COVID-19 is pushing millions of citizens into poverty.
For the first time, we invest 8 billion euros of EU budget money in cooperative defence R&D project.
Activists describe the EU's arms industry as immoral.
Exporting weapons to the Saudi-led coalition, which is waging war on Yemen. You have these huge amounts of money being made on the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan was mocked during the EU Defence Agency conference.
I very much hope that with Joe Biden we will have a partner in making, making multilateralism great again.
The anti-war movement is suggesting those who believe we will have a more just world under Joe Biden's presidency should examine the history books.
The Obama-Biden team ordered 10 times more airstrikes using drones than the previous US administration under George W. Bush. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Protest in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. Republic sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community, then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli, or for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has targeted more Chinese companies, accusing them of having ties with the country's military. China's top chip maker, SMIC, and oil giant, China National Offshore Oil Corporation, as well as two other firms, have been added to the so-called blacklist of the U.S. Defense Department. This comes amid escalating tensions between the world's two top economies on multiple fronts. China has slammed the move, saying it firmly opposes what it calls Washington's wanton oppression of Chinese companies. Beijing says the measure will severely harm America's interest and image. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman also urged Washington to, quote, stop abusing its national power and national security concepts to surpass foreign companies. Over the past weeks, several Chinese companies have been blacklisted under an executive order signed by Trump. Washington and Beijing have been at loggerheads over a host of issues ranging from trade, technology, security, human rights to COVID-19. That all intensified when Trump took office in 2017, with his administration launching a trade war with China, leading to a tit-for-tat tariffs measures. Since then, key Chinese industries, including telecoms giants Huawei and ZTE, as well as several social media apps, have also been targeted under different pretexts. Washington has also used the issues of Hong Kong and Taiwan to put more pressure on China. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. So why is the Trump administration keen on infuriating China? It seems the expanded blacklist is part of a bid to cement Trump's tough-on-China legacy before Democratic President-elect Joe Biden takes office on January the 20th.
I think this is definitely a part of a larger effort against China. The United States has to find another way of undermining China. Obviously, militarily, taking on China is a near impossible task. It would not be possible. The foot soldiers alone to occupy China just simply do not exist.
Relations between the world's two top economies have sunken to the lowest level since Trump's arrival in the White House. Just recently, even the Democrat-led House of Representatives passed a law to delist Chinese companies from stock exchange if they do not fully comply with the U.S. auditing rules, thus giving Trump one more tool to threaten Beijing before leaving office. But will Trump be able to inflict beyond repair damage to the Sino-U.S. relationship remains to be seen.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Fear and sorrow are two grave maladies for every nation, every crowd, and every individual. Fear and grief are two grave pests, but they can be eliminated with this Quranic announcement. Also, if we show resistance, they will be eliminated as well. This is based on Quranic ayah as well, in case of those who say our Lord is Allah, and further stand straight and steadfast, the angels descend on them. Fear you not, nor grieve. The Holy Quran, chapter 41, verse 30. Resistance has the same impact. If you want to be free of fear and sorrow, you should place resistance and steadfastness at the top of your agenda. If you do so, you will have neither fear nor sorrow. These are based on Quranic statements.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing nor I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, I should say that we have not properly carried out our duty in the area of the sacred defense. Of course, the tasks that our dear Sardar, the Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, mentioned are very good and valuable tasks. Nonetheless, they are few. We need more endeavors. Notice that the more we drift away from the sacred defense era, the closer we should get to it, ideologically speaking. Why is that? This is because distortion is lying in ambush. The hands of distortion are waiting in ambush. Well, you men of war live today, and you can say something to defend, but in 20 years, many of the participants today will not be there. In 30 years, more will be gone. The hand of distortion might distort this brilliant part of our history. Therefore, we should work. We should increase our knowledge and information. The sacred defense literature should be reinforced. The sacred defense literature is not a literary genre like other literary genres. It is not the case that we have epic, romantic, social, and even police literature, and therefore we can have the sacred defense literature as well. The sacred defense itself is a reservoir. Therefore, all kinds of literature can exist in it, and we can benefit from it.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
the debate.
Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Carver Tafway. Venezuela's free and fair parliamentary elections have been held. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's governing Socialist Party has regained control of the National Assembly and is now called to chart a path towards national reconciliation, amongst other things. Now, major opposition groups, including the one led by the U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido, boycotted the vote, calling it a fraud. In this debate, we will look at why the West, particularly the EU and the U.S., have not called this a free and fair election, while backing the self-proclaimed president and opposition leader, Juan Guaido. Joining us for this debate is Professor of International Studies at Unicinos, Bruno Lima Rocha, who joins us from Porto Alegre in Brazil. We also have activist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, who joins us from Los Angeles. I'd like to welcome you both. Ramiro Funes, let me first start with you. Looking at the parliamentary elections, the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the governing Socialist Party, has regained control of the National Assembly. What does this mean for Venezuela, and what message does this send?
Thank you for having me on. The fact that President Nicolas Maduro and the United Socialist Party of Venezuela have won the legislative branch of Venezuela's government means that there will be less deadlock. Let's not forget that for the past few years, the National Assembly has been directly operated not just by the Venezuelan opposition, but has been directly taking orders from the U.S. government, USAID, NGOs that are intended to destabilize Venezuela, privatize its oil. And so all efforts for the past few years, what we've seen from the National Assembly, is attempts to deadlock any sort of progress made by the socialist government of Venezuela. This means that it makes it harder for the PSUV to bring food to working class people, to provide jobs, to elevate and construct the economy, which has from day one been the goal. Now that the National Assembly, the opposition, has been relegated to a more minor role, and that the Chavistas in power can actually do the things that they've been wanting to do, I think what we're going to see is that we're going to see more construction, more progress in Venezuela. We're going to see more public services. We're going to see less attempts by the opposition to destabilize, and I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Okay, well, Bruno, why don't you tell us why the West, EU, and the U.S. Have described these elections as not being free and fair?
Well, first of all, they accuse Maduro's administration to not allowing for international observers to go forward and look what was going on in Venezuela. But I can't understand this measure, because Venezuela is under attack since so long time that they have to do their countermeasures against a coup d'etat, for example, that they suffered last April, last year. So they are alleging that the Venezuela election is not fair, but it's, I would say it's hypocritical, because in 2013, the Carter Center said that Maduro was elected in a fair election, and the State Department said that Capriles was stolen. So whatever they do in Venezuela, the West, the UN, or at least the USA and the EU, they will say that they're not fair. I think that their goal is to destabilize Venezuela and not allowing Venezuela to do to convert their oil revenues in some kind of industrialization, and first of all, to be sovereign in food production, because unhappily, the state of Venezuela do not produce the whole food they need. This is a lack of Maduro's economy. This was a lack in Chavez's economy, and they must overcome this and be sovereign in food production.
Well, Ramiro Funes, the U.S. has obviously not acknowledged, nor confirmed, nor accept the results of these elections. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that these elections were a, quote, political farce, which he said the U.S. condemns as a charade. Of course, the first question that comes to mind is, how can he say this when the U.S. presidential elections themselves have been called by some a charade?
That's exactly right. I mean, you compare the elections in Venezuela. First of all, let's acknowledge the fact that there have been more elections in Venezuela under the Bolivarian Revolution, which began in 1999 with the election of Hugo Chavez. There have been over 15 elections, countless, way more than the United States. And these are direct democratic elections. Venezuela is a democratic, direct republic. The United States is a representative republic, which is very different. In the United States, the people, what it really comes down to is the Electoral College, and we saw that play out in the battle between Trump and Biden, where the people don't really exercise political power. You have the marginalization of black and brown communities, of voters. In Venezuela, black, brown, indigenous people are given the power to vote. They're mobilized to vote. They're given the day off, first of all. And so what we see in Venezuela is more democracy. For the U.S. to go and claim that these elections were a sham is just ridiculous. And we really have to look at history to understand why this is nonsense. I mean, for example, you have the fact that in 1973, after the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile, who was a leftist president, they implemented Pinochet as a government. They had a farce election, which nobody participated in, and they called those democratic. The same thing in 2009 with the U.S. fact coup against Honduran President Manuel Zelaya. The military removed him from power. They had a sham election and imposed a right-wing military regime that still reigns. And in Bolivia, just last year, we saw that President Evo Morales, the first indigenous president, was removed from power for completely farcical reasons. The military again had a farcical election. The U.S. approved it, even though nobody participated. And the same thing. So we really have to keep this all with a grain of salt. One last thing on this point that I just want to mention is that the U.S., no matter what, it knows that these claims of election fraud are total nonsense. But the point is to stir trouble by any means. What the U.S. wants, just like in other countries, in Iran, in Russia, in China, in Venezuela, Nicaragua, what they want is destabilization. They want a lack of trust in the political system of that country to spur protests by any means. But the people of Venezuela do not want protests. They do not want uprisings. They want peace, stability, and prosperity.
Well, Bruno, if we want to take a look at perhaps the incoming U.S. administration headed by the president-elect Joe Biden, if confirmed or once confirmed, don't you think that it has lost some footing when you have the current president who doesn't accept the election results in the U.S., and yet you have the incoming president come to the table and then say, maybe, again, I'm asking your opinion here, what will it say, or what will the president-elect say, whoever he chooses to perhaps head any type of negotiations with Venezuela, and in particular Maduro?
Maybe. I would say that for us in Latin America, the Democrats are as bad as Republicans. I would quote, for example, Lyndon Johnson was vice president of John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was murdered, assassinated, and then they killed the one who killed John Kennedy, and they said that Brazil was under a communist threat and auxiliated the coup d'etat in Brazil in 1964. So from here, from Latin America, we can expect everything from the gringos, everything from the worst part of the gringos they come and they send to us. But I would say that Joe Biden maybe do some steps, for example, suspend some part of the blockade, or at least allow CITGO to do operations in U.S. CITGO is one of the almost a dozen PDVSA subsidiaries who are under blockade also, and who are under a kind of, I would say, white list for prohibition. Maybe, for example, if they suspend partially the blockade of Iran, Iran may produce more oil together with Venezuela. The last thing that Venezuela would need now would be an escalation in the blockade, and an escalation to destabilize Venezuela. But I don't think so. I think that Joe Biden would be so-called multilateralist and so-called through the UN, and would not do a direct provocation against Venezuela. He may do this, but I don't know if for the first 6 months he will do some steps, just like Mike Pompeo administration.
We need to discuss this a little bit further, since so much of the U.S. pressure on Venezuela has been exercised from Maduro Fidel in so many different ways. But, of course, all eyes would be, again, once and if President-elect Biden gets confirmed, what type of approach he's going to have. One of the headlines that cut our attention here that I'm going to ask you if you think this will be the case is that Biden will herald a shift in U.S. strategy towards Venezuela. And it goes on to say that Biden now has a historic opportunity to lead an international coalition to promote a political solution for Venezuela. This coming from Juan Gonzalez, who advised Biden on Latin American issues. Now, do you think that that will be the case, or will we still see that maximum pressure being exercised on Maduro and Venezuela?
That's a great question. I mean, I think no matter what, the maximum pressure has been and will continue to be imposed against Venezuela since 1999, when Chavez was elected. But it takes different forms. I think what we saw for the past 3 years, I mean, last year and the year before that, we saw a failed coup attempt in Venezuela where they tried to support these uprisings. We saw a more hard-fist approach at the border as well with Colombia, where they tried to foment crisis and protests. And at one point, Trump was even threatening military escalation. And that is what the Trump and Republican and the Pentagon wing of the U.S. ruling class represents. They represent hard power. They want guns. They want ships. They want weapons to be sent directly. You know, we even had the mercenary attack last year where U.S. mercenaries were directly involved in trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government. I think what we're going to see is a shift over to the typical Democratic Party style of overthrowing color revolutions, quote-unquote peaceful pro-democracy protests. And we saw this happen time and time again under the Obama administration. For example, under Obama, it was revealed that the U.S. government was funding right-wing underground radio stations that are, quote, pro-democracy in Cuba. We saw the Obama administration support a color revolution in Iran, the quote-unquote green revolution. They're going to continue this method because now the jig is up. People know that the United States for the past few years have been trying to go in and invade Venezuela directly, and they haven't been able to. And so now the U.S. ruling class is like, look, we need to figure out a better strategy to win a better PR for this regime change. The maximum pressure will continue, but it will now continue in the form of funding NGOs, trying to use soft power to control the Venezuelan people against developing a socialist economy.
Bruno, when you take a look at the U.S. and how it has gathered countries in Latin America to rally against Maduro, we can name other countries also. One of the ways that this has been done is the U.S. influence on the Organization of American States. Is that strategy going to still continue? Do you think under Biden, or right now, we're looking again at the U.S. power image that it had prior to have faded with the way that Trump handled things in general, and the standing that the U.S. has had has actually decreased? Do you think then perhaps Latin American countries, given this impression of the U.S., may have a different view on Maduro than ones who are against him?
I think, as I said before, maybe because the OEA, they had a ridiculous representation in the Bolivia crisis, and it was a so-called Frente Amplista from Uruguay who said that was a fraud in Bolivian election in 2019. And now Venezuela, they do have a chance to do another, I would say, arrow of alliance. First of all, with Bolivia and Cuba, they're strategic allies. And then with more moderate relations, I would say, with Mexico and Argentina. So the OEA may not have a huge role to do in our continent. And we will feel this, for example, in the next Honduran election, where when the State Department will be the first step to say that it was clean or not, because Honduran, they have two frauds consecutives. And first, the coup d'etat. The coup d'etat, as a colleague said, it was a goal for Hillary Clinton administration in the State Department. They also did, under the Democratic Party, a coup d'etat in 2012 in Paraguay and a coup d'etat here in Brazil. So I think that this momentum, this first six months, will be for the new administration of the U.S. to observe the continent and to, realize what will be their policy. Bad news, they do have a Gusano in the State Department, which is bad, so bad.
Well, one thing that it needs to do, let's talk about the challenges that really lie for Maduro now that he has won the parliamentary elections, his party, that is. And Ramiro, tell us, one of the biggest challenges that I see immediately is the fact that there needs to be legitimacy on Maduro himself. I mean, at this point, we're looking at 60 countries not recognizing him, but recognizing Guaido as the leader. And we could add, actually, the EU also, because we haven't mentioned how the EU seems like the EU is very fixated on Venezuela. They have come out and said that these elections, just like the U.S., are not free and fair. How can Maduro move forward to get his legitimacy in the first place and then move to try to fix some of the broken institutions, mainly economic ones, in order to push Venezuela forward?
I think Maduro, President Nicolas Maduro, is in a very tough situation because he has, as you mentioned, both divisions at home and abroad. For all transparency, I do support President Nicolas Maduro. I have some critiques, you know, of his administration, but overall, I think he's doing a pretty decent job at continuing the legacy of Hugo Chavez. However, one of the main issues in this election was a growing division between the Communist Party of Venezuela and the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, which is Maduro's party. There were actually some Communist Party members of Venezuela that were boycotting the PSUV that were going against. And so one of the reasons for that is that many people in Venezuela feel that some of the socialist reforms are not being implemented fast enough. Now, here's the thing. The only way to implement socialist reforms is by building and developing the country. Socialism has to be built on abundance. And as I mentioned earlier, for the past 2 or 3 years, the National Assembly has made it almost impossible for the Venezuelan government to develop its economy. Thankfully, because of countries like Iran, like China, like Russia and others, it's been able to lift more people out of poverty, but that's been very difficult to do. And so I think domestically, one way that Maduro can really unite, close ranks and unite the Venezuelan people is to accelerate those socialist reform programs, nationalize more industries, bring more wealth and prosperity to the broad masses of people. Now, internationally, that's a different question. When we're talking about the European Union, the United States, no matter what, and it's not about Maduro, it's about the fact that it's a government by and for the people that uses the profits of its oil for its own people. Even if it wasn't Maduro, if it was someone else, if he talked more politely, if he dressed better, they would still attack him with the same stuff, because at the end of the day, he's hurting the profits. He's hurting the profits of the big oil companies that run the European Union, that run the United States. So no matter what, I think we're going to continue to get these same messages from the EU, from the United States. But at the end of the day, that also is becoming a little less relevant, because now you have the rise of countries across, especially the Eurasian continent, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkey, Iran, you know, so many countries that are developing and creating a new multilateral world order where you don't have to rely on the U.S. and the EU anymore for their approval, because we can trade with Iran, we can trade with Kazakhstan, we can trade with China, and they're not going to try to tell us how to run our political system. And so I think while Maduro should definitely make efforts to close ranks at home, to re-radicalize the base around the Bolivarian project, I think no matter what, you know, the EU and the U.S., they're going to keep talking against Maduro, but it's kind of irrelevant at this point.
Yes, but there is relevancy, and my final question goes to you, Bruno, that you need this country to be able to generate the income, and its number one commodity is oil. You have the U.S. Mm-hmm. has been fixated on Venezuela, many say because of the oil. Do you think that there will be a chance that sanctions will allow, to be lifted, will allow Venezuela to generate income and then for the country to move forward? How do you see that future? If you can answer that in a minute.
Okay, that's the goal. That's a strategic goal. The Venezuela has so many problems in economics. They have a problem in the smuggling economy. They have maybe 4 to 5 currencies inside the territory, and they must not be so dependent in oil trade. If their sanctions, if the blockade is not relieved, I would say that they must do a kind of strategic alliance with the Eurasian power, as the colleague said. Otherwise, the people will be starving. They won't produce the abundance that they do need to socialize profits and products. Unhappily, that's a reality. They need oil, and oil is a curse. If you only have oil, oil is a curse.
Thank you for that. Let me thank our guest, Professor of International Studies at Unicinos, Bruno Lima Rocha, there talking to us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. Also, activist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, who spoke to us from Los Angeles. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Miko Etahwe, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have been discussing Imam Khomeini's teaching method for a couple of weeks. One of the most important features of Imam Khomeini's teaching method was that he observed the respect of ulama in various fields of Islamic sciences. Although he had a very critical spirit, as we had discussed earlier, he never allowed his students to disrespect other ulama and great figures, no matter if they were alive or dead. Today, we will touch upon this aspect of his personality. Stay tuned, please. Ayatollah Muhammad Emomi Kashani says, Imam Khomeini used to keep high esteem for ulama and jurisprudence and remember them very respectfully. when he wanted to reject the remarks on jurisprudence, principles of jurisprudence and philosophy, he would do it with respect. For example, he would not say, that a scholar has not realized this or has not paid attention to this. Late Hojjatul Islam Mustafa Zamani also said, whenever the Imam wanted to quote a subject from a scholar, he would remember him with respect, and if he didn't accept the subject, he would mention it with a special respect, and then would reject it with scientific argumentation. Yet, he would sometimes use the phrase Rizwanullah ta'ala alayh, meaning, may God be satisfied with him, for the scholar. He would reject the special respect for the writer, even the books that he thought were not usable for higher levels of jurisprudence. Another aspect of Imam Khomeini's teaching method was that he taught very attractively, smoothly, and expressively. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Fazil Lankarani narrated an interesting memory on this, saying, Imam Khomeini's way of expression in teaching was so sweet and expressive that nobody needed to ask another one to explain the Imam's view. He would directly present all subjects with his sweet and clear expression. Imam Khomeini would use special phrases and appropriate examples on abstract issues to elucidate them for students. Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani, one of the present sources of emulation, says in this regard, the Imam's general teaching method or his speech was in a way that he would refrain from complicated speaking and try to deliver intellectual and theoretical issues, which are often far-fetched for understanding with the clearest phrases and evident examples. He would even explicate rational and intellectual issues which are beyond senses and materials in the form of examples. Thus, his teaching and remarks had a special attraction in the seminary, and few could say that he had not benefited from the Imam's course, provided that he had the talent to learn that course. Hojjatul Islam Sayyid Kamal Faqih Imani also says, Imam Khomeini was very powerful in making the students understand courses. This caused the students and ulema to attend his classes, and the Salmasi Mosque would be crowded so much so that sometimes it would extend to the alley. Dear listeners, another aspect of Imam Khomeini's classes was that he was not rigid and used to tell jokes for refreshment of students. Late Hojjatul Islam Ali Dawani narrated this interesting memory. Although Imam Khomeini was very tacit, he would say a joke at the class so that the audience would laugh loudly. While he was indifferent and silent as if he had not said anything. For instance, one of his students from Azerbaijan area insisted on his opinion and the Imam wanted to silence him. At last, Imam Khomeini told him, "Yok," meaning no in Turkish. In this way, both that student and the audience laughed and he was silent. Imam Khomeini sometimes would even joke with his elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa, to refresh the class, although he deemed high respect for his scientific status. Hojjatul Islam Sayyid Abdul Majid Irawani says, one day in Holy Najaf, late Haj Agha Mustafa, who was a great mujtahid and a scholar, raised a question on a hadith. The Imam answered him, but his son was not convinced and asked for more explanation. The Imam said jokingly, don't say such things, lest people laugh saying that you are illiterate. Agha Mustafa said loudly, they will say I am your son. If I am illiterate, I am your son. Scientific courage and self-confidence were other aspects of Imam Khomeini's teaching method. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, among the features of Imam Khomeini's class was his broad-mindedness that he used to enforce at his courses. Therefore, the students would get used to it. He would let different views be raised in the course of teaching so that the students were exposed to various views and reach a desirable conclusion. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, Imam Khomeini created such a change in the seminary of Najaf that attracted us to him. Till then, the remarks of great jurisprudence used to be considered as a sacred domain. For example, if we said this is the view of late Ayatollah Naini, it would be considered as the last argument, since the personality of scholars had such a great impact on views. This had turned jurisprudence from a matter of research into a matter of imitation. Thus, students would not dare raise a view against the view of great figures. But Imam Khomeini caused a change and taught to the students to research on the views of great scholars. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to think a lot, although he was a very great researcher. Ayatollah Subhani says that once he had given several books on a specific topic, but the Imam kept only two of them and said that he had to contemplate to find the answer. Another element of Imam Khomeini's success in teaching method was that he would avoid prolixity. He used to express his view in the shortest and most useful possible way. Professor Ghulam Reza Awani says, one of the characteristics of Imam Khomeini's works and books was his succinctness. I mean that there is no room for prolixity in his books. The Imam mentions an issue and discusses it briefly. He usually quotes the words of all his teachers on an issue and then mentions his view. Dear listeners, next time we will dwell upon another aspect of Imam Khomeini's teaching method. God bless.
Of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.